my novel These Are the Stories We Tell was turned down by 20 publishers. That detail is the kind of cool thing to relate once a book has won awards and become incredibly successful. Everyone's talking about it, and the author's on Graham Norton, sitting on a couch in between George Clooney and Jodie Comer. They're there to talk about the blockbuster movie of the book, and everyone's like, no way, those publishers are assholes. I bet they're all drowning in their Prosecco this evening. However, that's not what happened. 20 publishers turned it down. I published it myself on Amazon. Some people bought it. Some others didn't. To be honest, the ratio between the number of people on Earth who didn't buy it and those who did is pretty large, and there's no movie. I can see why it was turned down. My agent sent it to crime fiction editors. The book concerns the murder of a 5-year-old girl, and the principal character is a young female detective constable, first week in the job. It has a regulation police procedural written all over it. However, it's not really a crime novel. It's much more vague than that. It's so vague, it's really a literary novel, one of those hard-to-place literary novels. So we'll call it a literary crime novel. But I can imagine crime editors thinking, not crimey enough, not credible enough, too surreal for the procedural. And of course, there's always a possibility they just didn't like it. To be honest, there isn't really a part for George Clooney, although there is one for Jodie Comer, if she's listening and is interested in playing a young detective constable who's consumed by guilt and sorrow and gets disturbingly drawn into a world inhabited by lonely women and hauntingly melancholic paintings. When you see a line or verse from a song quoted in a book, the writer ought to have sought and paid for permission to use the lyric. It's a thing. My original manuscript for These Are the Stories was filled with song and movie lines for which I'd have needed to ask permission. I did it to add colour when the book was circulating around all those editors who didn't want it. However, since I ultimately ended up publishing it myself, it wasn't going to be practical to pay for all those permissions, so I ditched all of them, bar one. There's a scene where a character diffuses a road rage incident by inserting himself in the drama. He doesn't speak to the protagonists. He doesn't try to smooth things over. He just sings a completely inane and inappropriate song that has everyone looking at him like he's mad. Whether this would work in real life or not doesn't matter, what with this being art and all, but in the narrative it takes the heat from the moment. Everyone calms down. There's no reason why the song had to be We All Stand Together from Rupert and the Frog Chorus. It could have been a nursery rhyme or some standard that's old enough to be in the public domain. Somehow, though, Rupert and the Frog Chorus just seemed right, and soon enough, I couldn't imagine the guy singing anything else. So, for the first time in recorded history, I paid for a few lines from a song. There was some discussion about the utter pointlessness of this around the family dinner table. Of the four of us, three found it utterly pointless. Fortunately, I'm king. That thing, I argued, with its so bizarre an idea it'll likely lead to us all getting invited to have lunch with Paul McCartney hasn't happened yet, but there's still time. I'd read that scene now, but then I'd have to sing We All Stand Together, and no one wants that. Plus, maybe I don't have the rights to use the tune. I mean, that might not be included in the £120 I paid to use the lines in the book. I don't know. But mainly, I don't want to sing. This scene is set the following day and includes the aftermath to the Frog Chorus incident. He heard about the guy outside yesterday, the one who defused the argument situation by invoking the Frog Chorus song. Argument situation was a phrase that people had started using, though no one was able to define how an argument situation was any different from an argument, which is what it would have been called in the past. I watched it from the super's window, said Faraday. Wow, said Rose, you'd have got a great view from there. We didn't know about it till it was all over. She glanced at the fat man, but he was on a call. There was no one else in the open plan. It was kind of weird and incredible at the same time, said Faraday. I watched the video, said Rose. I saw there were people filming. It went viral. Then last night there was this wave, apparently. The Frog Chorus wave across the country. A spontaneous movement of people diffusing situations by singing We All Stand Together. Really? A guy in Fulham stood between these three guys who were abusing a young Muslim woman in a train. Packed carriage. He inserted himself in the story. You can see in the video he's bricking it, to be honest. But good on him, you know? These thugs are telling the woman to go home. He puts himself in there. Then he starts singing the Frog Chorus. How'd that work out for him? He got stabbed, said Rose. Looks like he died on the spot. I guess that's the end of that viral sensation. Rose looked across the dividers between the desks. Big eyes, thought Faraday. She has big eyes, very expressive. What do you think of that, she asked, when Faraday didn't immediately respond. Faraday lowered her gaze and looked at the desk. As a story, it seemed pitched at exactly the same level as every other one currently in the news cycle. One bleak, avoidable tragedy piled on top of the next. till the senses of the world had been crushed beneath their weight. The whole Frog Corps cycle has a grim Coen Brothers black humour feel to it, don't you think? Maybe it'll be a movie one day. There's a lot of competition, said Faraday. I might make a 30-second slot in a sketch show. Guess you're right. Faraday picked up her phone and dialed the number for technical services, smiling at Rose to bring their conversation to an end. Rose mouthed, good luck, presumably knowing that Faraday's first call of the day would be to try to sort out her computer issues. Faraday liked Rose. Maybe she and Rose could become friends. There was something about her, a detachment from the real world that she needed. In Rosie's world, all the awfulness was happening to other people and none of it affected her. The sentiment wasn't uncommon amongst people their age. What they themselves saw as pragmatically dealing with the world that had been given to them, the older generation saw as living in denial, marching into the abyss with eyes closed and music blaring through their earphones. Somehow a similar detachment in Rose seemed refreshing. Hey, you're through to tech services, said an unnaturally positive voice after one ring. The suddenness of it caught Faraday off guard, and all she could think to say at first was, hello. Hey, said the young man, my name's Toby. I'll be your technical collaboration operative this morning. Can you give me your station code, personal ID number, and Matrix username? Okay, my username is BFaraday141, said Beth. I'm in Abingdon. I need the station code, said Toby. I'm not sure. Don't you have that? I need you to give me the station code for our security protocols. Just a second. I'm not allowed to hold. Toby, said Faraday. This is Toby. Toby still sounded like he was enjoying the call. Faraday wondered if he was medicated or whether he insulated himself against the horror show of working any underfunded call centre by hiding behind a mask of good humour. In the evening he went home, broke down and cried. Hold, I'll be 5 seconds. I can't hold. I tried to buy a wave from across the desk. Faraday looked over the low partition. Rose was holding a piece of paper with 4512 written on it, and Faraday responded with a thumbs up. 4512, she said. Awesome, said Toby. Just checking. That's Abingdon Station. Yes, it is. And your ID? Echo 4896 Hotel Zulu. Okie dokie, just bear with me a sec. Faraday stared at her blank computer screen while she waited. In her head, she started counting down to the next problem, which she knew was coming. 5, 4... This system doesn't recognise that ID number, sorry. Can you read it to me again? I'll tell you the problem, Toby, said Faraday. Yesterday was my first day in the detective branch, but I don't yet have the physical ID card to hand. It's all been done by email. She paused, thinking that that might be enough of an explanation, but it seemed Toby needed it laid out for him. So I don't actually know my new detective ID number, because I don't have the card, and I don't have access to email. Why don't you have access to email? My new login isn't working. You're in a new post? Yes. You should have been given a new username and password. I was. What seems to be the problem? It doesn't work. Ah, I see. And that's why you've called technical services today. Yes. Awesome. I see the problem. A beat. She could see Toby in sleek black headset nodding at the other end of the line. I can't help you. What do you mean you can't help me? I need your ID. I don't have it. Not my problem, he said. The lightness remained in his voice. Toby, said Faraday firmly, I need you to help me out here. You'll need to speak to HR and get your new ID number. Without that, I can't do anything. Deep breath. Now she understood the tone of the smiling assassin. It was harder to get angry with someone who was being so upbeat. Thank you, she said, doing the only thing she could and bringing the conversation to an end. Is there anything else I can help you with today? Asked Toby breezily. Goodbye, Toby, said Faraday, unable to bring herself to just hang up. Thank you, said Toby. The line went dead. Faraday looked at the phone list in the divider, then dialed the number for HR. She caught Rose's eye. Rose made a gesture of hopelessness, and Faraday couldn't help smiling. You're through to Human Resource Directorate, said a voice. Faraday hesitated a second, unsure if the voice was a recording, but then when it didn't immediately head into a list of options, she presumed that once again she'd found an actual person. Good morning, said Faraday, deciding to get straight to it. This is Detective Constable Faraday in Abingdon, second day in the detective branch. I need to know when I'm going to get my new ID card, and I'd also be grateful if you could tell me what my new ID number is. Currently, the issuing of new ID cards is 6 months in arrears. 6 months, said Faraday, repeating the detail. And you should have received an email with your new employment details and posting, and this would have included your identification number. I can't get access to my email, said Faraday, so if you could just give it to me over the phone, please. I'm not permitted to do that. A beat. Rose was now on a call. The fat man was still staring straight ahead at the partition before him, saying nothing, but nodding occasionally. I need you to give it to me over the phone. Now. No impatience in her voice. Hopelessness, in fact. Just hopelessness. I can't. Not over the phone. Privacy protocols. The woman in HR didn't sound nearly as positive as Toby in technical services. How do I get the ID number? I can email it to you.
You can email it?
Yes. I can't open emails because I can't get into the system. Not without my ID number.
I can put a hard copy of the email in the internal post, said the woman from HR.
Faraday let a few moments go by. Elastic time, where the seconds came and went, stretched and bent and collapsed. How long will that take, she asked. HR was based in Swindon. She imagined some great network of old-fashioned piping and that somewhere in Swindon the woman in HR would put a letter in a small tube. She'd press a button and a 1930s pneumatic system would send the tube whizzing through the old pipes to Abingdon.
Faraday found herself looking around the room to see if such a system was in place in the office, even though she knew that if it did exist, there was no way it'd be connected to Swindon.
4 to 6 weeks. Faraday hung up. She sat in traffic and looked at her card. The old ID card, her face from 3 years previously, slowly fading away. Every time she took the card from her pocket now, it seemed she diminished a little more. She liked the notion that it was representative of her old self fading away, but she couldn't escape the uncomfortable feeling that perhaps her identity was fading away with it. She was losing herself. She looked back at the clock. She wasn't sure how long she'd been sitting at the lights, but the time in the clock read exactly as it had when she'd looked previously, even though it felt as though she'd been sitting here for several minutes. Time was refusing to move ahead, as if it too had stopped at the red light. Here she was, in a car in a traffic jam, the lady at the window in a guest house in Kazakhstan. To her left there were several large blue and black plastic bags, dumped in an overflowing heap, rubbish spilling out where the bags had been ripped asunder by seagulls or foxes. In the midst of the rubbish there was a cat eating some rotting, fetid garbage. For the moment she thought it was an odd thing for the cat to be doing, then she realised it was a giant rat, its long, thin tail trailing behind. By the heap of rubbish there were railings, beyond that a small park, where several children were playing, a group of mothers chatting. They looked young. One of them was dressed in a bra and shorts, her shoulders covered in a gaudy tattoo. Faraday looked away, telling herself not to judge. Up ahead the lights changed and Faraday stared forward, waiting for the traffic to move. The car at the front drove off, then the one behind. The next, a maroon Jaguar F-Type, two cars ahead of Faraday, remained where it was. 1 second became two, then three. The car in front of Faraday beeped its horn. Then, like a dog setting off the other hounds in the neighbourhood, the car behind Faraday joined in. No one had much patience anymore. Car horns filled the air. A Ford Kuga in black accelerated quickly from behind, already doing over 30 by the time it passed Faraday, diving in ahead of the stationary Jaguar and away through the lights. Someone followed. The lights changed. There were three cars now overtaking the queue on the outside as the car in front of Faraday tried to ease its way out. And then traffic was coming in the other direction, and there was more beeping and cursing and fists waving and shouting and snarled faces and anger filling the air. This time no one hit anyone else, and the traffic continued on its way. Faraday advanced the car as the queue shuffled forward to fill the gaps, then turned on her hazards, quickly got out, stepping from her furiously struggling air conditioning into the fire, and walked to the car ahead of her. Cars, like everything else in the blasted, blistering summer, were suffering. Breakdowns were commonplace. Vehicles dumped at the side of the road becoming a regular feature. Those cars did not usually last long before they were plundered or vandalised. The engine in the maroon F-Type was running smoothly, however, a beautiful, low sound. This, thought Faraday, is why people say that engines purr. She came up alongside the driver and looked into the car. A woman, no passengers. She was wearing a light summer dress, white with a neat green and blue floral pattern. Sea salt, thought Faraday. She wore a headscarf, wisps of blonde hair sticking out the front and shoulder length behind. She was in her early 30s and looked cool sitting there. The air conditioning in the Jaguar F-Type must be of the highest quality, thought Faraday. She tapped the window. The woman was staring straight ahead and hadn't noticed Faraday come up alongside. She did not turn. Faraday tapped again, but she already realised there was nothing wrong with the car, nothing wrong with the woman. She had zoned out, that was all. She was staring into space, did not see the other traffic, did not see the red light, would not have noticed when it changed green.
and just as she did not hear the tapping at the window, she would not have heard the orchestra of car horns. To her right, the car stopped, the lights moved on to the next stage and the four-way signal, and cars started passing from directly opposite on the junction. Faraday took a step to her right and then leaned over so that she was looking directly in through the windscreen. The woman looked through her. "Damn," muttered Faraday. Then she walked around the front of the car to the passenger side and tried the door handle. The door opened. Cold air rushed out. About to get in, she looked down the row of traffic. She swiped her hand across her throat that indicated that the traffic would have to go round the jag in her own car. She could see a couple of exasperated faces. Then she got into the car, sat down and closed the door. "God, this is nice," she thought. The dashboard, a beautiful harmony of colour and fabric, style and digital readouts. The air was cooler than the superintendent's office. "If I had this car, I'd sit in it until October," she thought. There was music playing. Sinatra. "Why Try to Change Me Now" from the 1959 album No One Cares. Her father used to listen to it all the time. Perhaps it didn't play during every single meal the four of them sat and ate at the dinner table, but it had grown in frequency in her thoughts until it formed part of the fabric of her childhood memory. A melancholic end of the evening, alone in a bar with a bottle of whiskey album, the sound of it seemed to define so much about her. It never seemed out of place in their small house in Somerset, this sound that was so much part of the furniture, but hearing it now, out of its familiar context, she recognised the music was perfect for this day, for this endless summer. Sinatra's melancholic voice had always infected her. She'd eaten chicken cooked in mustard and soy sauce and butter and white wine. She'd drunk iced tea, her parents had drunk wine. She'd rolled her eyes at her brother, they'd made jokes about her mum's age, even though she was several years younger than their dad. Her brother had teased her about her football knowledge and on through the teenage years until she'd escaped, even though there was nothing particular to escape from. She just needed to get out, that was all. She hadn't heard Frank Sinatra in nearly 10 years, and there he was, as familiar as the eyes that stared back at her in the mirror. "Sorry, who are you?" Snap of the fingers and she was back. She looked at the driver, who was staring at her curiously, albeit with no judgment. The lights had changed twice. Maybe the lights had changed 6 or 10 times, and the cars behind were already passing the Jaguar. Faraday took the ID card from her pocket. "DC Faraday, Thames Valley," she said. The driver studied the card and looked at Faraday. "You're fading away," she said. "I know, I'll get a new card shortly. That wasn't what I meant." "Is there a problem?" asked Faraday, not allowing the conversation to linger for a second on the peculiarity of her own personal disappearance, whatever that meant. "Why?" asked the driver. "Why are you in my car?" "You zoned out." "Did I?" "Yes, the lights changed. People had to drive around you." The driver looked at the car slotting in front of her, and in the mirror as another squeezed awkwardly in behind Faraday's VW at the last moment. She turned back to Faraday, holding her gaze, a long look, questioning, as though Faraday might have the answers, trying to work out where she'd been. "You zoned out," repeated Faraday. "Yes, I must have." "Are you prone to moments of Mitty-esque fantasy?" "What is that, Mitty-esque? Walter Mitty?" "I don't know who that is. Has this happened before?" "I don't know. I don't think so. What were you thinking about? Is everything okay?" Her brow furrowed. "Is everything okay? Really? Have you watched the news? Have you looked around you? Have you breathed the air?" Together they looked around. There were two of the mothers arguing in the park while two children cried. There was a queue of traffic in every direction and likewise the sound of horns blaring. There were piles of rubbish in the streets and amongst those piles the largest rat that anyone who looked upon it had ever seen. "This is a good day," she said. "This is a good spot. There's worse. All over, there's worse. Welcome to the finest parts of the UK where the rats are the size of dogs and anger is let loose." She held Faraday's gaze throughout, waiting for the objection. It was inevitable, of course, wasn't it, that all the rage of the internet would one day become the rage of the world. The barriers have gone, and the hounds of ignorance and antagonism are unleashed. "Yes," said Faraday simply, "they are." Finally, they broke the gaze, looking away, now both staring ahead, facing the reality of a baking hot day in mid-August. "Where were you?" asked Faraday. "When?" "When you zoned out. Where'd you gone?" The lights were changing, each time a shortened full causing drivers to accelerate quickly, to push the limits of the red lights, to swerve out the way of oncoming traffic. An accident was inevitable. "This," said the driver, "this music takes me back, that's all. My parents used to listen to it all the time, my dad, and he died a few weeks ago. We were going through his things. My brother had put this in the charity shop pile and I rescued it. Hadn't heard it in, 10 years. Just thought about it today and I stuck it on. The sound of my childhood gave me goosebumps. Now Faraday looked at it again, their eyes meeting across the short distance of the car. "Where were you?" the woman asked. "You seem to zone out yourself." Faraday brought the look, took in the traffic situation around them. The time in the clock was the same as the time had been when she stepped out into the heat. "We should move," she said, suddenly snapping the moment. "You'll have the green light in a second. I need to get back to my car." She paused and then added, "Sorry about your dad." And then, without looking at her again, without affirming that the driver was all right, albeit she clearly was, Faraday got out of the car, took a last glance at the king rat eating garbage with dominion, and walked back to her VW. A glance along the queue behind, the angry stares and resentment, door open and back into the second class, markedly inferior air conditioning. Hazards off as the traffic lights changed from red to green. Finally, the clock in her car ticked round to the next minute, as though it had made a positive decision to move on, and the cars ahead began to move.